Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
Hello and welcome everybody to episode number 161 of Linux in the Ham Shack. I am your co-host Russ, K5TUX. Across from me is another co-host of the show, Cheryl.
Hello everyone.
Whose microphone is actually still working.
Yay!
This is all very good news. And get this, we have breaking news on the Linux in the Ham Shack podcast. We have with us a new co-host. Out of the wilds of northern Colorado, we have Rich, KD0RG.
Hello, everybody! Yay!
Woo!
Flailing Kermit arms, everyone.
That's
okay.
Everyone knows what the flailing Kermit arms, right? Yay!
Yeah, well, if they're driving, that's probably not a good idea,
right.
But okay.
Keep your hands on the wheel. Save it for later if absolutely necessary.
I'm not driving.
For a change.
That's right. For a change.
Well, that's good. We're glad to have you not driving, and we're glad to have you sitting in on the show. Pete is going to be on hiatus for a little while. He's dealing with family and life concerns for a little while. He'll be back on the show sometimes. Pete will be on the, or yeah, I said Pete. Yeah. Rich will be on the show sometimes or all the time or I don't know what. But anyway, it's a new and bright future for Linux in the Ham Shack. Good times from here on out.
Well, yeah.
It's a dynamic future.
That's right. It's a dynamic, wonderful future. And the best part about the episode today is Rich did 90% of the work.
Which is very cool.
Yeah, which is very cool for us. So. So I'm not sure how you fit that in between some of the stuff we're going to talk about later, like where you were over the weekend and what you do for a day job and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know, you managed to put stuff in here that we'd never get a chance to get around to. But this is all good. And the best part about it is, since we've had to do a couple of shows on our own, well, actually more than a couple of shows on our own, I've had to do a lot of the talking, which, you know, is okay. It is a podcast. It is an audio medium, and there is some talking required. I kind of went into it knowing that, but it's always nice to be able to bounce it off to someone else and have them do the talking for a little while so I can sit back and drink my beer and eat my
dinner.
Cheese and crackers and stuff like that. So and we'll talk a little bit more about the beer later on. There's some of that coming up in Cheryl's Recipe Corner. We have an amazingly jam-packed show. We've been able to keep the show down to about an hour for quite a while now, which is
not going to happen tonight.
Yeah, it's exactly where I want to keep it, but I don't see that happening tonight. So I guess we better just dive on in. All right, Rich, we'll share some of these reading duties, but since you're new to the program, we're going to just throw you to the wolves. We'll go ahead and since you put this story in here, you should know it really well. So we're going to find out if Gary Pierce is going to jump down your throat like he likes to jump down ours and see how well you can read your own story.
Yes. Well, that's a whole episode. Winterfield Day is here. Winterfield Day Association, WFDA, is a dedicated group of amateur radio operators who believe that emergency communications in a winter environment is just as important as the preparations and practice that is done each summer, but with some additional unique operational concerns. They believe, as do those entities of ARR organizations like ARES and RACES, that maintaining your operational skills should not be limited to fair weather scenarios. And the page goes on. It's actually from winterfieldday.com. This used to be put on, I think it's the same organization, but it was SPAR, I think. But I'm forgetting. Winterfield Day is next weekend. It's just like Summerfield Day, except you go out there in the cold.
And it's not quite as long.
Have you ever done Winterfield Day, Russ?
I have not done Winterfield Day, and I think I would really like to do it this week when it comes up. But the thing is, we're busy this weekend. Now, we're not busy until later in the afternoon, so it's entirely possible that I could jump on for an hour or two while this is going on. But I'm not committing to anything at this point. But no, I have not participated up to as of now.
Well, it's you know, it's gained traction in the last couple of years, I'll say. I actually helped last year with my son's radio club. They decided to do Winter Field Day, and it was cold and windy and
winter.
Still fun. Yeah. We actually camped out there. So anyway, the only thing really different this year for anybody who does it, the exchange is a little easier, which is good. All bands except 12, 17, 30, and 60 meters. You can operate from indoors if you'd like, and the exchange is your call sign, your category, and the categories are I, O, or H for indoor, outdoor, or home, your section, and then, I don't know. You go to this winterfieldday.com/rules.html, and you'll get it all there.
Are the sections based on, like, the AWRL Field Day sections?
Yes, they are the same sections as the ARRL. In the rules, it says or RAC section, and I actually – or DX for outside of U.S. and Canada. So RAC, what is that, Republic of Canada?
I don't know. We don't have Pete here to answer Canadian questions anymore, so –
That's right.
We'll have to let the Royal Air Command, is that what that is? That's the RAC that I'm aware of.
Amateurs of Canada.
It has to do with, Radio
Amateurs. Radio Amateurs of Canada. Okay.
There we go.
Yes, there we go. All right, sure. Well, very cool. So if you get a chance to participate in Winter Field Day this coming weekend, you should definitely do that. Maybe you'll hear me on the air. Will we hear you on the air, Richard? Will you be out there? I should say Rich, not Richard.
Just to keep everybody straight.
Those are big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, probably not. It'll the club that I'll be helping out is Whiskey Zero Charlie Alpha, W0CA. So if be on the listen for those guys.
All right, sounds good. Very good. So you want to read the next one? Can you read the next one?
Now that I've got a mouthful.
That's why I'm doing it to you, because you decided to take a bite. That's why.
Hang on.
Can I just say that Winter Field Day is Jeez, I was going to give a date because I know that when I listen to these podcasts, it's always a little. It's on the 31st, January 30th and 31st, 2016.
Well, now that you've put topical information in, I'm going to do my best to get it out so it's actually there before the time.
Yeah, since instead of waiting,
I actually have been doing much better about that lately. So
you've had very short.
I didn't
podcasts.
Mean it as a criticism, only to help the listener.
Right. No, we didn't take it that way, so it's not a problem. All right, and you're done eating, so go ahead.
All right. Old-fashioned ham radio proves its reliability in the age of texting. Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 3115 runs a fairly standard operation. For years, the post from Wichita, Kansas, has been known as a place where veterans can relax and socialize. But the post offers something else tucked away in a broom closet, a fully operational amateur radio station. The W0VFW Amateur Radio Club began in 2007, when club trustee Dennis Godby teamed up with other VFW members to bring amateur radio to the post. He's quoted as saying, "I was sitting down here talking to a barfly and he said, 'You know the commander is a ham operator,'" Godby recounted. With his old radio, power supply, and a Morse code key, Godby set up shop and a folding table in the back of the building. Now the club has grown to more than 20 regular operators. And this information was found on Kansas.com. And there's additional information at WichitaMemorial3115.com.
I love the call sign, W0BFW.
Yeah.
Yes, well played. And this,
well, and the W could actually be attributed to Wichita VFW, right. So,
well, it could have been K0VFW as well for Kansas.
Right, true, but it's easy to remember the W. VFW.
So. Yeah, unfortunately, we in the United States only get a couple of options for our prefix there. So
yes, no, I understand that, but what I'm saying, never mind, forget that I said anything.
When you get your ham radio license, you'll understand these things.
I'm not stupid.
Maybe they could have made it WK0VFW Wichita, Kansas.
Wow.
But anyway.
And I'd be willing to bet that's probably available too. So
yeah, probably.
Because I don't think anyone goes for those really long call signs when they sign up for the Vanity Call program. I don't know a lot of 2x3s that were Vanity Calls, unless the other ones just aren't available. That's cool, though.
You know, I included this story because I was, I don't know if you saw my earlier note, this old-fashioned ham radio, it's just a stigma that we'll never get rid of. And this story did nothing, in my opinion, to help portray the image of amateur radio in any kind of a modern light. I'm going to get kicked off the show. how do I put this? I don't hear the kids saying, "Hey, Bob, let's go down to the VFW and hang out."
No, and that's very true.
Although I have to say, here in Springfield, just up the road, we have VFW 639, I think it is.
Uh-huh.
And that is like one of the most happening places around here. They have biker events and
all kinds of stuff.
They just have stuff going on like every day of the year up there. So the VFW is not just a bunch of old veterans hanging around drinking whiskey and socializing. You know, there's really...
That one isn't. There's others that still are.
Well, right, right. The title of the story as was proves its reliability in the age of texting, and then goes on to talk about a bunch of old people sitting at a VFW using a radio in a broom closet. Yeah, I don't see... I don't see how that's like endearing itself to the text generation. I guess you're right about that.
So that's why I included it, because it was like, oh, another one of these stories, you know, that the image and the whole, it's a problem. I see it as a problem. So, but anyway, one that can be overcome.
Yeah, I think the boundaries of amateur radio are being pushed on a daily basis, and I hope that our show, you know, elucidates some of those boundaries that are being pushed and gets more people interested in the hobby. I know in the time that we've been doing the show, dozens of people, particularly, you know, Linux users who are getting interested in ham radio and becoming licensed, even if they're not actively using ham radio, just to be a part of the system. And oh, is your microphone crapping out again? Enough about radio from a broom closet. Yeah, a broom closet. We should probably move on. And I would read this next one, although there's not much to read, and I'm kind of curious about why this one was included as well. And since Rich included this one, I'm just going to let you have it.
I included it because it was cool. Okay.
All right, cool. Very
cool. WXBot, an APRS weather forecast auto responder. WXBot is an APRS-IS listener app that listens for messages and responds with a brief U.S. National Weather Service forecast. Send an APRS message to KI6WJP consisting of any single character and receive back a weather forecast for your location. Optionally, you can specify where, when, or what. The where can take the following form: call sign or an object known to api.aprs.fi that has a location, including CWOP stations and AIS ships. You can include a 5-digit zip code, 4 or 6 character maidenhead grid square, or latitude longitude using decimal degrees. This comes from KI6WJP's website. It's sites.google. Well, you'll probably put it in the show notes. I don't need to do that.
It will definitely be in the show notes, yes.
Here's what it does. I can be going down the road, and I can be, oh, I wonder what the weather's like over here. I can send an APRS message to KI6WJP with the zip code of the place I'm going to, and I will get back a weather report. I think that is cool.
So, sorry, you caught both of us eating. Are you APRS enabled in the truck?
I'm not, but I should be. But to me, it's just, you know, when you're out there, like let's say you're driving cross country and you hear something on the radio, and I don't know why we wouldn't be able to listen to just the weather radio, but it was just, to me, it was just a pretty cool little project. One of those projects, you know, it's open source. It's a Perl script, actually. His listener thing. And let's see. It's the openness of APRS. It just, you can do these things. You're not inhibited by, you know, some third party company. You can just create something and have it be cool.
I know lots of people, and we talk about APRS on the show almost an inordinate amount, but it's one part of amateur radio that I have never touched on at all. I don't have any devices that are APRS enabled. I do have a Garmin GPS unit that has an external connector, so I have the ability to use APRS. I have just never actually done so. But I hear all of these cool things that can be done with it, every time I hear about APRS, I just go back to the idea that it's basically a packet forwarding and locator service, and that doesn't like blow my hair back. So I'm not sure what it's going to take for me to actually try APRS. This does sound interesting.
What it'll take. It will take, and this is true of a lot of these new technologies, it takes out of the box working, and some of this stuff is just the learning curve is too big. And you know, it's one thing we'll talk about later at the, you know, when I was doing the ambassador thing, it's like, yeah, people are interested, but they don't want to buy a Raspberry Pi and then go have to buy a card and then have to figure out how to, you know, write an image to the card and then have to figure out, you know, how to download amateur radio software for the Raspberry Pi. They want one box. They want a box. They open it up. They plug it in. It works. And unfortunately, we're not there yet.
Well, I don't know. That may be true for most people, but I'm not afraid of having a bunch of stuff cobbled together and wires running everywhere. All you have to do is look at my shack to say that doesn't scare me in the least. But it's still a technology that I haven't approached, and I couldn't give you a reason why. I just never have.
You know, I have. You can send messages. If you go to aprs.fi, I think you can send messages from there. And I've done that before, and I've received some too, because I knew somebody was out on the road, and so I sent them a message. And if they didn't get it, they told me they got it later. You know, if I didn't get a message back right away, they told me they got it later. I should probably look more into it as well.
Well, that's right. Well, this will definitely be something for those aficionados of APRS, and there are many that listen to our show. I know that because we get lots of feedback about it when we talk about it. So I know this will interest many. It just, at the moment, does not interest me. But as we'll learn later, I did delve into another ham radio technology for the first time and had some great success with it. So maybe this is the next thing on my plate. We'll find out.
Very good.
So I'm going to go ahead and read the next story. We're shifting over into open source topics from our amateur radio topics. And the first one, well, actually, you know what? I'm not going to do that because I'm going to have Rich talk about why this is even in here, because this is, it's interesting. Well, there's sort of two conjoined stories here that we're going to talk about. I'm going to let you address the text of the stories and why you thought they were worthy of mention. Not the second one, but the first one.
Yeah, so it's a brief history of Debian. Appendix A, the Debian Manifesto, which was written by Ian Murdoch. And this particular, let's see, appendix was last revised in January of 94. And this was, I guess he was writing about why Debian was created. Ian Murdoch was, you know, founder, creator of Debian, Russ? I guess founder, you would say, right?
Founder and creator, probably. He gets both titles. He and Deb, the Deb of Debian.
Yeah.
Because the Ian of Ian is him.
Yes.
Were both founders and creators, I guess you would put.
So there's a little, I'll start reading. Appendix A, the Debian Manifesto. Debian Linux is a brand new kind of Linux distribution. Rather than being developed by one isolated individual or group, as other distributions of Linux have been developed in the past, Debian is being developed openly in the spirit of Linux and GNU. The primary purpose of the Debian project is to finally create a distribution that lives up to the Linux name. Debian is being carefully and conscientiously put together and will be maintained and supported with similar care. Many distributions have started out as fairly good systems, but as time passes, attention to maintaining the distribution becomes a secondary concern. A case in point is the Soft Landing Linux system, better known as SLS. It is quite possibly the most bug-ridden and badly maintained Linux distribution available. Unfortunately, it is also quite possibly the most popular. It is, without question, the distribution that attracts the most attention from the many commercial distributors of Linux that have surfaced to capitalize on the growing popularity of the operating system. I just wanted to include it to give a little background as to Debian, and then a little history there, too, in the Linux loop in 94. Jeez, what was I doing? I don't even know. But
I actually was running Debian 0.9 in 1994. So
that's I'm glad I know that. So had you ever heard of Soft Landing Linux before?
Yes, SLS and Slackware and Debian were all contemporaneous back in 1994, and it was kind of, you had to pick between one of those three. Red Hat was still in the infantest of infancies at the time. So everything had come basically from SLS. And actually, while you were reading the story talking about Debian as a Linux distribution, I could hear Richard Stallman screaming from wherever he's at that it's GNU Linux.
I know.
Yes, I am well aware of SLS. There's a wonderful flowchart, which if I can find a link to it, I will. And if our wonderful friends in the chat room are listening to this, they can find it for me and post it. Basically shows a left to right progression of the very core Linuxes that started back in 1992, and then all of the Linux distributions and how they evolved from them in a giant, well-crafted flowchart. And if you look at the very early days of Linux, you will see Red Hat, SLS, Slackware, and Debian. And basically every other Linux distribution that's out there has somehow evolved from them.
Ah, very good. I've heard of this flowchart. I don't think I've ever seen it, though.
I have seen it. It's a wonderful thing to behold, actually. Sometimes data is presented in ways that are just magnificent, and that is one of those things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very good.
I have it right here.
All right. Post the link in the chat room so we can all be amazed. Cool. I'm going to look at it myself because I love looking at this thing.
At least I hope that's it.
Well, I'll tell you in a second because I know the one I'm talking about.
Well, it looks like probably what you're talking about.
No, that is not
that it. Is not
that
it.
That is
okay.
Not it. Sorry. Here, I'll try and find it while Rich continues to talk about the manifesto.
Well, it was just a little bit of history, and I thought it would be appropriate to look back and talk a little bit about Ian Murdoch and the significance that he had on everything that we're using. Most people are using Ubuntu or a variant of, which is a variant, you know, that all is based on Debian and pretty important in the Linux, the Linux world.
Okay, I did find it. I'm going to post the link. And I wasn't paying attention to anything you said because I was looking.
We were talking about story number two.
No, I know what we're doing. I was just...
Just the significance of the Debian Manifesto.
Okay, that link that I posted in the show notes is one version. I mean, it's mm-hmm. One copy of it. So,
and it is correctly GNU/Linux. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Okay. I can spend all day. Look, pretty colors.
It looks like the Starship Enterprise.
Yeah, kind of. But if you look at the very far left of the image, you can see Yggdrasil, which I think that's a Tolkien reference? Or is that... I've heard that word before. But anyway, the MCC Interim, which created SLS, which became Slackware, SUSE, and that line. The Red Hat line, and Debian. And then you can see that every other distribution that has ever been evolved from them.
It is a mythical tree that connects the nine worlds and Norse cosmology.
Oh, it's Norse, so it's an actual Scandinavian type thing. I know I'd seen it before, I just couldn't remember where. It's probably used in like Dungeons and Dragons or something. Anyway,
Yelper Linux all by itself.
so let's all get sidetracked by the wonderful flowchart.
All right. Well, there we have it. Shall I go to the next story?
All right, yes. We probably should just move on to the next story. Anyway, if you want to check out the flowchart, I will definitely have that information in the show notes as well. So, and it's actually called the Linux Distribution Timeline. So if you do a Google image search for Linux Distribution Timeline, you'll be able to find it. No problems at all.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's just fascinating to see all the, where everything came from. Gives you a little history.
Well, it also makes you feel good if you listen to this show because we push Debian and Debian-based distributions, and you just know that, now you know, if you didn't know already, that Debian comes from the very early days of Linux. It's kind of like, it kind of came from the big Linux bang.
Kind of, yeah. So it's, yeah, it's right there in the beginning.
I'm not supposed to be the comedic part of the show, so.
No, it's supposed to be Rich.
That's right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's like, wait, right. Sorry.
Falling down on the job.
He didn't get the memo.
Okay. I'll work on it.
I have to say, though.
The next story is such a bummer. It's hard.
Right. That's okay. We'll get through it quick.
Okay. You want to do it?
No, you can do it.
Police confirm Ian Murdoch arrest before threatened suicide. Prominent open source programmer Ian Murdoch died in an apparent suicide Monday, December 28th, mere days after a violent encounter with San Francisco police that led to his arrest. Ian Murdoch, 42, was best known for his contributions to the Linux operating system, founding the Debian Project, a widely used Linux distribution, while a student at Purdue University in Indiana. Murdoch had a distinguished career in programming, most recently working for San Francisco-based Docker Incorporated, and previously working at Salesforce, Sun Microsystems, and as a chief technology officer of the Linux Foundation. Public concern about Murdoch's well-being grew on Sunday when, in a series of posts on Twitter, he vaguely described a violent encounter with San Francisco police, accusing the department of beating him up and sexually assaulting him during an arrest. I heard about the story early on, and you just couldn't find anything. And I immediately, you know, I'm reading the reaction of people, and it just, to me, I'm like, you know, we don't know anything. We have some tweets from a guy who doesn't seem like he was really. People suggested that his account got hacked, and you can find those tweets online if you want. But at any rate, he was obviously going through some pretty tough times, and or something was going on.
Yeah, something. It seemed like he wasn't mentally stable at that point, or something. So.
Yeah, and he had gone to a neighbor's house and was causing a disturbance. You know, I want to speculate because, of course, I think I know what happened. But anyway, the tweets. I don't. Did you read the tweets, Russ?
I did not actually read the tweets.
Yeah, I did, and they were just vague and weird, and basically like somebody that was schizophrenic or something was typing them.
And let me just. I'll just say it when you he tried to compare it to some of the, you know, brutality that has gone on recently, and I don't even know if I want to use that word because I think
you can use any words you want. This is not a news program. You can
because is what I'm getting at is a lot of times stuff that happens is perfectly justified and there are reasons for it, and if you were in the same position you'd do it too. If you were in that police car in you know in Ferguson. I don't know what went on, but if certain stories are true, I don't know that I would have done anything different. I hate to be like that, but you know, you just wish everyone minded their P's and Q's. And you know, the New York City, the over the cigarettes, I forget his name. That one seemed a little over the top. But anyway, all right. Now, see, I really got off the rails here. But
that's okay. That's what we do here.
You're banging on your neighbor's door. The police are called out, and you want to go in there and be a jerk about it. What do you think's going to happen? I mean, you know. So to me, you got to take care of those issues, and you know, going out and getting drunk or whatever. I don't know. You know. Anyway. Yeah.
Well, it's unfortunate whatever happened to Ian Murdoch, but it's often the case that brilliant people have social problems. Some of the most intelligent people in the world are, I think, what most of us would consider maladjusted, because I think their brains are oriented towards their intellect and not social skills. I don't think I'm too out of line in saying that. And even the open source community is not without prior art in this realm. I mean, all you have to do is go back to Hans Reiser, and we talked about him, I think, early on in the show when he was having his issues, so... Smart people have problems.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll say that when you see an issue very clearly and nobody else can see it the way that, you know, it should be seen, it can be very difficult. It can be very difficult to, you know, to find, oh man, what am I trying to say? You know, I don't know that there's a solution, but I really feel bad for the whole thing, both sides, you know. I don't think we'll ever know what the deal was with the neighbor, because it was apparently on the block that he lived on. And then he was taken to the hospital, and then he went back home, and, you know, they had to come back and arrest him again, and I don't know. It was just a...
Yeah, I was just looking at the tweets that he had posted that are archived, and it was, yeah, one of his comments was, they beat me up, they had to take me to the hospital, I needed stitches, and I still had to pay $25,000 to get out of jail after they beat me up. So...
But the police, and that's in that San Francisco, or sfbay.ca article, their spokeswoman suggested that he was banging his head on the metal cage separating the
the
back seat from the front right. seat, so that he was kind of, you know,
something was going
doing,
on
doing it to himself.
Yeah.
And again, you know, you're boy if anyway it's just an unfortunate situation.
Yeah, well, the upshot is it led to the death of one of the pioneers of Linux, and probably, you know, up until that time, a good person. I guess we can say they're all good people, right? So it's unfortunate. This did actually happen back in late December, shortly after Christmas. So we hadn't talked about it on the show. I didn't know that we necessarily wanted to address it, but I'm sure most people are aware that, or who are interested in Linux anyway, knew about Ian Murdoch's passing. But
I was reluctant to talk about it. It's just so wrong. And it's like you were saying, Russ, you know, these really smart people, sometimes they just, you know, for whatever reason, I don't know. It's just incredibly unfortunate. Yeah. I'll be quiet now.
That's not necessary. So I'm not sure how we're going to follow that story with the next story, but I guess we're going to do it.
Well, we can say that now things are getting maintained and fixed, which is what Ian Murdoch would have wanted.
Exactly. Okay.
Perfect. A bug that can leak crypto keys was patched in OpenSSH. This is always good news. What's not always good news is the fact that OpenSSH reveals vulnerabilities within itself fairly often. But anyway, a critical bug that can leak secret cryptographic keys has just been fixed in OpenSSH, one of the more widely used implementations of the Secure Shell protocol. The vulnerability resides only in the version end users use to connect to servers. Well, that's kind of unfortunate because that's the part that's important. And it's not in versions used by servers themselves. A maliciously configured server could exploit it to obtain the contents of the connecting computer's memory, including the private encryption key used for the SSH connections. The bug is a result of code that enables an experimental roaming feature in OpenSSH versions 5.4 through 7.1. Quote, the matching server code has never been shipped, but the client code was enabled by default and could be tricked by a malicious server into leaking client memory to the server, including private client user keys, OpenSSH officials wrote in the advisory. So that is definitely unfortunate, and if you happen to be running a Linux system where you're actually using OpenSSH as the protocol on your system, which if you're using Linux, you probably are, you want to make sure that you check your system against the advisory. Make sure that if you are using a vulnerable version that you get it patched immediately, if not sooner. Information on this was found from ArsTechnica.com, and there's some additional information at seclist.org, which actually contains the text of the vulnerability, and of course links to those will be in the show notes. So hopefully, if you're actually paying attention to the security of your system, you'll have this patch before you even hear about it from us. But if you're hearing about it from us, go patch your system now. Turn off the show, patch your system.
Come back later.
Come back and listen to the rest.
Gosh, I got to go. I'll see you guys.
Bye-bye.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
Russ, what does it all mean?
Well, let's see.
You know what? I say this. You know, my lucrative career in the logistics industry doesn't allow me for a lot of time to be SSHing into everything. You know what I mean? I rarely use SSH. I can't remember ever using it other than to log into a computer, you know, in on the same LAN.
Right.
So what does it mean?
That's exactly what it means, though. That is a typical use scenario, but things like PuTTY or other remote desktop protocols or something may actually use OpenSSH underneath. So if you connect remotely, if you use some sort of client to connect remotely to another server, whether it's actually using just, you know, SSH at the command line or some other method, it's probably best to make sure that your SSL transport layer is patched and secure, because there's probably a lot of stuff on your system that relies on it.
The way the thing was written, would I have to connect to a malicious server?
My understanding from reading the text of the article that you posted is that, yes, you actually have to initiate the connection, and then the remote server has to be set up in such a way that it's expecting a connection from a compromised client.
Ah, see.
To initiate the exploit.
Is there any way to get that through, like, if Rich's wife got an email?
No, this is specifically using SSH.
Okay.
So that's not likely.
So if it's like let's say I were SSHing into blacksparrowmedia.net, I probably wouldn't need to worry about it too much.
You would not have to worry about it, because I would not be setting up my server to try and infiltrate the corrupted
I should say a server that I knew, like I knew, right. You know,
right.
Like my maybe if I worked for a company that allowed me to do that or something, I don't know.
Yes, it would not be likely, because it sounds like the server has to be set up. The server has to be hacked to be expecting an inbound connection from a compromised client to attempt to extract the memory contents and the private keys. So,
but perhaps I was offered a free shell client on a Bulgarian server. Then I might, you know.
You might possibly want to patch your client then.
Okay, all right. So. Just kidding, Bulgaria. Sorry, I love it.
Yeah, so, well, if you start getting hate mail from Bulgaria, we want to read it. Excellent, yes. Make sure you patch your systems anyway.
Kleewick is giving us all kinds of advice.
He also says, for all systems, app-get update, and I will amend that to say for all Debian-based systems, app-get update. For Red Hat-based systems, you want to do a yum update. He also says, management of all your appliances, load balancers, firewalls, and VPN systems probably use SSH, and also management software uses SSH to establish trust between systems. And just now, don't run the SSH client off the USB stick you found in the parking lot. That's always good advice. Yes, if you find a USB stick lying anywhere, do not plug it into anything that can read it. Okay? If you want to stick it into a random bodily orifice, I'm saying you're probably good with that, but don't put it in a computer. Okay?
Wow.
Well, I'm just saying, if you want to put it in your ear, you're safer that way, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay, whatever.
Very good.
Aren't you glad I chose ear?
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right, so yesterday we both saw a great thing about Linux. So, Cheryl, you want to read this one?
Sure.
Okay.
Rubik's Cube is solved in just over 1 second using Linux. Jay Flatland and Paul Rose of Kansas City, Missouri, built an extremely fast Rubik's Cube solving robot and are in the process of applying for a world record. The Cube Solver features 6 stepper motors, 3D printed accessories including tiny feet that fit in holes drilled into the center square on each side of the toy, and webcams. The hobbyists then feed data into a PC application running on Linux. That application determines the cube's state, feeds the cube's state into an implementation of the Cosimba Rubik's Cube solving algorithm, and determines a set of moves to solve the cube very rapidly, Flatland said. The robot isn't entirely consistent. 2 tests clock the machine at 1.196 seconds and 1.152 seconds, but the third time the program really came through, racing to a finish time in 1.047 seconds.
Yeah, this was very cool. There's like a 5-minute YouTube video out there of them explaining the parts that they used to create the machine, the assembly of the Arduino-based controller for the stepper motors, and then they showed the whole thing in action, and they're using a set of 4 HP off-the-shelf webcams to have the software analyze the state of the cube. And the only thing they had to do was actually drill some small holes into the center of each side of the Rubik's Cube so that they could fit the teeth of the motors in so it could actually just turn the sides. And when I saw that, I was wondering if Guinness might not reject their claim of a of a world record because they've actually altered the cube in some way. And then I was thinking, why didn't they just use something like a suction cup on the end of the motor squeezed to each of the six sides? It should be just as effective at turning the sides of the cube without actually having to modify the cube. Now, whether that actually is a concern for Guinness, I really don't know, but it seems to me like they could have done something very similar without having to actually modify the Rubik's Cube in order for the robot to manipulate it. Regardless of any of that, this thing is fantastic. The video is wonderful to watch, and to see this computer just take a randomly shuffled Rubik's Cube and solve it in roughly a second is pretty amazing. What amazed me most is that the cube didn't just explode while it was being manipulated, because I mean, it's turned so incredibly fast you can't even see it. It's just like he like pulled the paper off one of the cameras, hit the button, and the thing was just like done. And it just surprised me that the toy actually held up
under
and
the pressure,
and didn't just like disintegrate while it was being solved.
Yeah, well, one thing that you took out of the story that was probably kind of pertinent was the fact that for the last time they did it, they actually covered the lenses on the webcams, hand scrambled it, and put it back in the machine, and it got it in 1.047 seconds.
Well, they did that just to confirm that the computer wasn't figuring out the solution while
ahead of time.
Yeah, doing it ahead of time.
Right.
But it's clear from the demonstration they did that the computer doesn't need any lead time to figure out how to do the solution. It's clearly doing it in microseconds. And the fact that it takes about a second to actually do the solution is just the physical limitations of the motors. If the motors could turn faster, it could be solved faster.
Right, in milliseconds.
But honestly, I believe if the motors did turn any faster, the cube
would
explode.
It, right.
Because, yes.
So.
Yeah, it would probably come apart.
Yeah.
Wow, that is cool.
And it was all done by two guys with Linux, a bunch of 3D printed parts in their spare time. I mean, truly amazing stuff that happens in this universe. And it runs on Linux.
Yeah, that is slick.
Yep. All right, so very cool. So we've moved on from our amateur radio topics into our open source topics, and now we're into Linux in the Ham Shack. Yay!
Woo!
And, Rich, I'm going to let you tackle these first two, since they're kind of quick and dirty, and let's get them done.
Oh, yeah. Well, Klog, our favorite KDE logging program, Klog 0.9.2.3, now in Japanese and with an icon. Klog's author, Jaime Roibles, happily reports that the latest version, 0.9.2.3, has just been released. He says it's not the biggest release of Klog, but it brings some new features, like the new icon and Japanese translations. Jaime says, quote, "In this release, I want to I'm doing this all wrong, aren't I? Jaime says, quote, "In this release, I want to specially thank JL3OXR, who has added the Japanese translation, as well as reported and fixed several bugs," unquote.
I just want to point out that that sounded like really Mexico, and he's from Spain.
I grew up on the north side, bro, and it's like the only accent I got, okay? So that's all I got.
All I can say is I hope he's not listening to the show, because I think we're going to hear about it.
All right, I'm sorry.
No, it's entirely fine. I just think it's hilarious.
Well, I'll work on it.
Okay.
There needs to be more podcasters from Spain. That's how I pick up accents as I listen to people. All right. So there's a new release of Klog, and it's great. You know what? It's great. It's still being actively developed.
Yeah, I've never used Klog. Is Klog one of the ones that's Klog because it's KDE based, or is it just happened to be Klog? I'm not actually familiar with it.
No, it's KDE. It'll drag everything in,
right?
Which is why I don't use it, because there's to be installed Kate data, Kate part, KDE runtime data, KDE libs,
and all of
500 packages,
right? And all of Qt, which is the biggest part of it. So
yes,
yeah. All right, but if you happen to be running KDE, this one's probably for you. I mean, most of the KDE based apps are really wonderful apps if you happen to be using KDE as a desktop. If you're not, I don't recommend trying to run them under GNOME, for example, because basically you have to install all of KDE and all of KDE's fundamental parts just to run a, you know, 200K application. So
yeah, it's very pretty, you know, in the Synaptic Package Manager, you can click on Get Screenshot. It's a very good looking logging program, and I've used it before in the past, you know, probably 5 years ago, and it's very capable.
All right, well, that is good news. So for KDE folks, which we don't really talk about a lot because I personally am not a KDE user, so that's unfortunate for those folks who are, but here's some KDE, some love for you. We threw you a bone.
Well, and so one program is getting updated and another one is disappearing. Bug number 812407, remove CWIRC. Zero popcorn dep removed. That was the title of an email sent to, I think it's the Debian Bugs list. I belong to one of the lists, maybe the Debian Hams mailing list, and this got filtered through there, I think. But anyway, CWIRC is a XChat plugin that allows you to send CW over
IRC.
XChat. Yeah. IRC, yes. And according to Popcorn, which is I think they meant popularity contest. Oh, PopCon. Yeah, there it is, PopCon. Popularity contest is a package that people can, and, you know, as Hams, maybe we ought to think about this. I never include it, or I never install it, but what it does is it sends a little message back to Debian and says, this piece of software is being used. So whether or not this is actually being used or not, it's certainly, yeah, oh, it is, I'm sorry. See, I was checking if popularity contest was installed, and I do have it installed. And is what it does is it sends back to, you know, Debian that, oh yeah, this package is being used. Well, they have zero users for CWIRC, and because XChat is listed as a dependency and XChat is being deprecated, I think, in favor of HexChat, Ted is telling us that Pierre hasn't supported CWIRC in years, and it was never converted to Pulse Audio. We have the whole story. Thank you, Ted.
Yes, thank you very much. But this actually brings up an interesting point, because you said that you don't install Pulse Audio, sorry.
Popularity contest.
Yeah, popularity contest on your machines, and I don't either. I have never been a part of the popularity contest on any of my boxes, but this actually makes me think that it might be worth doing, particularly on machines where I might use some lesser known software or lesser used software. I had never really considered it before, and I had never really considered that there would be a reason to do it. Now I see that there might actually be a reason to do it. So it might get me to reconsider using popularity contests going forward.
That's the message I wanted to send.
All right. Well, good deal. I'm glad you sent that message out there. Received loud and clear. Got you 5.9.
I thought this was funny. I searched for CWIRC like homepage, and it's on a MySpace page. It's really great.
Well, MySpace.
Anyway,
like 6 months or 12 months ago, didn't MySpace decide that they wanted to try and resurge and become a thing again?
I don't know.
Because MySpace has been essentially dead ever since the advent of Facebook, but I kind of gathered that there were some people actually moving back to MySpace recently. Oh,
and I'm sorry, it's not a MySpace page. Never mind. You can look at that link and see why I thought that.
Yes, I see why you might think that. But anyway, that link will be in the show notes, as well as links to all the other things we've been talking about, just in case we haven't made that abundantly clear.
I will say there still are a lot of bands on MySpace.
Yeah, there are. I think a lot of them are moving to Reverb Nation, though, which is actually much better site for that kind of thing than MySpace. I think MySpace is dead and will stay that way. We'll find out, I guess. So, anyway, moving on, we're going to talk about the fact, I think that's interesting about this next story is that you went to the, and I can't remember if it's the Northern or North Colorado Hamfest this past weekend, and yes, you went there as an ambassador for Linux in the Ham Shack, but you came home from the North Colorado Hamfest as a host of Linux in the Ham Shack, so you didn't technically have to be an ambassador there because you're actually part of the show. Either way, let's hear a little bit about your experiences. And I did get your interview audio. I don't know that I can actually play it, but if I can, I'll tell you what.
Sorry. Cheryl's, there goes the beer.
It's actually Russ's beer. What?
So is it drinkable?
No.
You don't like that one either, huh?
Let me open mine.
Okay.
We're good.
Anyway, we were talking about Rich being at the North Colorado Ham Fest as an ambassador / host of Linux in the Ham Shack. Yeah, so if I happen to be able to insert the three little interviews that you did from the show, they will be heard right now.
Okay, this is Rich, KD0RG. I'm here with
KD0NE, K-Bone.
And why did you come to the Ham Fest today?
I've got 6 million CD players to sell.
I saw those new in the box.
Yes, they are. And, you know, you too could become a rich entrepreneur on eBay if you bought all my stock and I'd even make a good deal.
And, well, that's what brought you here. Are you a Linux user?
Yes, I am. Ubuntu and Raspberry, but I can't remember.
Yeah, what do you use, Raspbian?
Yeah, Raspbian, that's it.
All right. Well, very good. 7-3.
Ciao, ciao for now, now.
Okay, we have another unsuspecting guest here at the Ham Fest. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Steve, WB0NFQ.
And how long have you been using Linux?
Probably going on 6 years. How long has Linux been around?
Oh, longer than 6 years. But that's great. Now, what you were talking to me earlier about, I think, an apt-get command. What happened?
Working on setting up a Raspberry Pi, and it boots, I log in, everything's happy. Nothing more, get update, apt-get upgrade, and reboot -R, and it never came back again.
Wah, 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 wah. What happened?
Ultimately, I do remember seeing some file system errors before I rebooted it, and replacing the microSD card was the issue. I haven't gone back to troubleshoot to see if I throw away the old card or not, but replacing a new card and starting over, so back up those microSDs is a really, really good idea.
Did you buy anything at the Hamfest?
I did not. My last hope is the drawings.
Mine too. 73.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, last interview of the day. I'm here with
Skylar Fennell, KD0WHB.
And what is this really cool product that you have here?
I'm calling it the NanoStar. It's a portable all-star node. And what you can do with it, if you're in RF range of this device, which has a little transmitter receiver, you can actually link up to nodes all around the world. And you can use All-Star or Echolink on it, and actually both at the same time.
And it's pretty cool. So you created this thing, radio inside, Pofeng, whatever you want to call it, cheap Chinese handheld, yeah. And it's connected to a sound card, and that's connected to a Pi, and you download a customized image. Is this correct?
Yeah, that's
on the right track.
Yeah, that's correct. It has the Baofeng BF888 transmitter, and you just have to download the image from allstarlink.org. It's called Dial, and they make it for the Pi or a regular old PC computer. Any old desktop will work. And yeah.
So there's available, but certainly images available for us excellent Linux users.
Yep, the new Dial image is Raspbian based for the Pi, and it's Debian based if you want to download it for a computer. And they used to use CentOS on the ACID distribution, but they just came out with Dial a couple months ago. And so you basically boot it up and configure your transmitter and receiver, and then put your call sign in and get your password in, and you're All-Star.
That is pretty awesome. Now, let's see. Skylar, you look like you're 12. How old are you?
I am 17 years old. I'm a senior in high school.
Well, congratulations. It's a great product. Did you give me your call sign?
It's Kilowatt Delta Zero Whiskey Hotel Bravo, KD0WHB.
And just so I can get some Linux street street cred. We're interviewing from the command line, aren't we?
Yep, and I'm talking into this little high shield right here. And we used a record, looks like.
All right. Hey, thanks, man. I got to get my Linux street cred. Know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'll say 73 from Amateur Radio World. This is KD0WHB.
And 73 from Rich, KD0RG.
And if not, you heard nothing, and we've moved on to the next part of the show. So,
which is perfectly fine.
So anyway, tell us about North Colorado Hamfest.
It was great. I was completely unprepared. I had great expectations for myself, and you know, I met about half of them. But as far as getting stuff working and being able to show things off, but I'll say there was plenty of enthusiasm for Linux. I found myself going out to the front of the table. I had three monitors going, and I had a Raspberry Pi connected to each one. And you know, one had GPredict going for a while and some logging stuff, and another one, let's see, was that my recording machine? I have a Wolfson audio card on an old Raspberry Pi, has built-in microphones, so we were recording right into the Raspberry Pi via the command line, which which is pretty cool. Because you might be a Linux nerd if you can record audio from the command line. That's my joke.
I like your joke.
Maybe I should say you might have good Linux foo if you can
insert
it here from the command line.
That's your non-redneck version of your joke.
Yes.
It's like crap.
The redneck sounds better, don't it? All right. Anyway, lots of people using Linux, and it was great. I mean, I spent 90% of the time out in front of the table talking to people. It was just, you know, there was enough room to do that, and people were constantly coming by. My kids were there, you know, they were helping with my son's club. They were selling stuff in a different area, and you know, every time they said, oh yeah, every time we went and saw Dad, he was talking to people because it was nonstop, and it was great. And I handed out a bunch of cards, and hopefully they're listening. And Craig stopped by, K0CWB, and I will mention him. And I don't know if I'm going to mention anybody else. And you know why I'm going to mention Craig?
Why?
Why?
He'll say, I don't know. Because he's the only one with a profile on HamQTH. No one else had a profile on HamQTH. I would encourage everybody, go to HamQTH, fill out your profile, add a picture. It's a little pet peeve of mine. So I'll mention names, not call signs. Tyler stopped by, Doug, Rod, Diana, Randall, Rick, Brian, Terry, Arif, who is a Ubuntu ham and doesn't even have a profile on HamQTH. WBZ, oh no, that Steve, I said I wasn't doing call signs. Steve stopped by, and Skyler. And these are just people that I wrote their call signs and names down. There were others too, so forgive me if I forgot you. But Craig's a longtime listener to the show, and he stopped by and said hi, and it was just great. It was a lot of fun to talk Linux and to, you know, I demoed a few things. People were interested in the Raspberry Pis. The Pi 2 with the 1 gig of RAM and the 1 gigahertz processor, it can run just about everything. I didn't have a lot going on, but I had GPredict going with about 8 satellites, and it was handling that just fine. Let's see, what did I have on? I had Xlog on one, and anyway, it was a lot of fun. It was just talking Linux to people. It really made me my day. I was happy the whole weekend. Plus the Broncos won.
Well, we won't talk about that. So was the Colorado Hamfest 1 day or 2 days?
It's just 1 day, and as most hamfests in Colorado go, hamfests, not conventions, they're really only for half a day in the morning. And some hamfests, I don't know how it is in other areas of the country, but a lot of people, they don't even stick around for the last drawing. Not at this one. Everybody pretty much stayed till the end, but then as soon as the drawing was done, they're out the door, you know. So anyway, that's just the way it goes. But it was a lot of fun. If anybody wants to do the ambassador thing, man, I had a great time talking Linux with people.
Well, we always have a great time when we go to fests, whether they be Linux or ham, because the people are great. And we actually got, especially at Hamvention, but we've been to other places as too. We get what I think is more interest than I figure we will. It always seems like we're more popular than we
probably should be, than or
we,
whatever.
Not that yeah. we probably should be, that than we think we're going to be, I think is what it is.
Yeah.
Which is always wonderful. And we were wondering, actually, or Cheryl was wondering if I had bothered to send cards to you, because I wasn't sure.
Business cards.
But you said that you gave out cards, so I'm guessing you got some.
I got a whole big box, and I handed about a third of them out, I think. Ooh. Told people about the show, you know, and it's like anything, a lot of people have never heard, oh, what's a podcast? Oh, do I have to listen live? Oh, how can I listen to that? So, you know, those questions got answered. I was just happy to do it. It was a lot of fun. I was really trying to do some pretty crazy things that I thought would be really cool. I just didn't have the time to do them. And I'll mention one. I had Linksys WRT54G version 1.1. So I put the DDWRT on there, and it has this DNS mask thing. Russ, maybe you know something about this. But anyway, is what I was trying to do is if people connected to my Wi-Fi network, I wanted to send any and all DNS requests to a single page that would show them. And if you want, I'll maybe make a screenshot of the page, but it said, oh, no internet here. You can only download episodes of, and then I had a big Linux in the Ham Shack picture. And then at the bottom were two links to episode like 159 and 160. And I had those on my Raspberry Pi running Nginx. And I actually was able to do it with my phone at one point, but other people's phones would override, like if the Wi-Fi didn't work, it would automatically go through the network. So it was kind of a fail on my part.
Well, that's not really a fail on your part. I think you had it configured correctly. It's just that when some phones, particularly iPhones, detect that there's another way to get to the network they're supposed to get to, they'll use it.
Yeah, and I think that's what was happening. Now, Craig, who I mentioned, K0CWB, he actually put in the 168.73.149, I think is what I used. Oh, that's right. I had put the, anyway, he found the Nginx page, but, I think I'll have to do a little more work on that. I don't know how to fool the phones, but anyway, it was fun.
No, that's neat. I'm glad that you even tried to do that, kind of do your captive portal setup using the Wi-Fi router. That's very cool. Even we don't go to that extreme.
Man, you know all them technical terms. Captive portal.
Yeah. Well, that's what it is. I deal with captive portals on a daily basis. So.
I see. Excellent. Oh, see, I should have called you an asshole. So one thing, one question that came up more than once, I'd say a half dozen times, people were asking, you know, for CDs with amateur radio software installed, and I just, you know, a live DVD. So anyway, that might be the next project I have to embark on, a redo of the old Ham OS there. Oh, and by the way, that was a live DVD and based on Debian, so maybe I'll have to redo that.
Well, I was going to actually address that because I knew you had mentioned it to me in an email before the program, and I was going to say it's probably not worth your time to bother, because in the last, either the last episode or the episode before that, rather, I talked about the Debian Ham Radio Pure Blend.
Yes.
Which is exactly that. It is a DVD live image with all of the ham radio software installed on it. So
yeah, I actually downloaded that and checked it out.
Of course, it won't have any of the software that is not included in the Debian repos, so there is some room there for improvement, I guess, if you wanted to try and package on some things that Debian doesn't currently package. But as something to do as a giveaway at upcoming fests or at Hamvention, for example, the Debian Ham Radio Pure Blend is probably adequate, at least, to get people to be able to just pop something in and be able to try out ham radio software. Now, again, it won't be every software package that there is, but it's enough of them, I think, to give them to whet the appetite.
Absolutely, and that's all people really wanted. Because again, it's if you've never used it before, there's that learning curve. Well, how do I get software? Where's the software located? You know, do I have to go to websites and download it? That, you know, this it's still for the new user. It's still a little. It's a foreign concept to have it all right there in a package manager or you know on a on the Raspberry Pi they have an ad software. It's similar to the Software Center. It's a, you know a little different format.
Right.
But anyway.
Nope, and that's something we've wanted to address in the past. I've actually wanted to do a distribution of my own, you know, the Hamshack Linux distribution or whatever it is, and kind of associated with the program and all of that. The best we've been able to come up with so far is basically either using someone else's, i.e. yours, or what was the other one?
KB0OIQ, Andy.
Yeah. Andy's Ham Radio Linux or something like that and just kind of put our logo on it, which, you know, that goes over reasonably well. I think what we'll probably do is brand the Ham Radio Pure Blend, at least for the time being, for upcoming events until we either get the time or something better comes along.
I think that's a great idea. I did hear you talking about it, and I did fire it up, and it it's got just about everything you need, and you can find things. Yeah. You know, there's still a lot of. This goes back to that you know maintaining theme that we were talking about earlier, and I guess it's a carryover from the early days. People need an icon in the menu, otherwise they don't know it's there.
Right.
Anyway. And there were still some, like when you install Aldo, which is a Morse code tutor, you know, there's nothing. You install it and then it doesn't show up. And if you're a new user, you're like, well, I don't know where it went. Right. So anyway.
No, and that's definitely something we should address on future programs, how to find those things that are on your system, but you just don't know where.
Excellent. So I'll wrap up the HamFest saying it was a success and we should move on to adventures in SSTV.
All right, well, let's do that. These are my adventures in SSTV as of the last week. And we have talked about on this show SSTV quite a bit, I would say. And SSTV is one of those technologies that I've kind of looked at but never actually tried to play in along the lines of APRS. So I decided that I was tired of never having, you know, to put it in a vulgar way, popped my SSTV cherry. So I actually downloaded QSSTV on my Hamshack computer that I've got sitting here next to me, and I determined that I wasn't going to get up from my seat until I actually learned how to use the stupid thing. That being the case, I actually did learn how to use it. It took some doing. SlowScan TV is, to put it in, you know, mildly, an interesting communication medium when it comes to ham radio. It's not your single sideband or CW transmission or even PSK31. It is definitely not any of those. It requires a little bit of advanced preparation. It requires digital mode interface because you are actually doing a digital mode. SlowScan TV is in a way like things like PSK31 already. In that you have digital information that's going from your computer that needs to be encoded in one direction and decoded in the other direction. But beyond that, you're actually encoding and decoding what, for the bandwidth available, would be considered fairly large bits of data, because you're talking about, as at least in my case, 500 by 400 pixel images. What's nice about SlowScan TV is that you actually get and receive, you actually get and send pictures. Now, you can set up your QSSTV, which, by the way, is a native SSTV application that we have talked about before. Links to it, of course, will be in the show notes. You can set that up on your Linux machine and just set it up in receive only. You can set it up for automatic decode. You can find the SSTV channel frequencies for the band that you want to monitor. You can set your SSTV application for that band. And then you can just receive, and you can see, you know, SSTV CQs coming in and conversations going back and forth from stations around the world, and you never have to initiate a conversation. You can just see what people are sending, and basically what people are sending is kind of like a QSL card, except instead of a, you know, a QSL, you're actually having one picture that shows, you know, station calling CQSSTV, and then another station responding, you know, with a signal report, and then another station responding with a 7-3 and then moving on. But all of this, of course, is done in pictures, which makes it kind of interesting. The biggest hurdle for me was trying to figure out where to get the pictures and how to set up the pictures properly to send to someone else so that they could respond to me. Because if you're just watching the pictures roll in, you don't have to do any of that. All you have to do is just wait for them to come in. They come in, you see the pictures, and then away you go. But if you actually want to send slow scan TV data, QSSTV actually has a full mechanism for allowing you to create templates which overlay pictures that you can then send out. And these overlays will allow you to include information like your call sign, your QTH, your grid square, the time, the date, the signal report, comments, and such as those. And then the application allows you to fill in that data dynamically, and then it will overlay that data onto a picture using a template form so that you can respond to a CQ using slow scan, or you can send a 7-3, or you can send a weather report or anything like that. Plus, it keeps 3 separate galleries of picture information, one of which is your templates, one of which is your transmitted images, and one of which is your received images. And then it also provides a facility for editing both templates and images. And this is all built into QSSTV. What I found out that you had to do, or the workflow that I eventually got through, was that I created a base image for myself. There are several widths and heights that are considered standard format. I chose 500 by 400 pixels that seemed to be used quite a bit in the SSTV that I was receiving. I made a picture using the Linux in the Ham Shack logo, using a very large text version of my call sign, and then I created various templates to overlay that image. One where I had a CQ, one where I had a response, including a caller's call sign, a caller's report, time and date, and then another one where I had, a 7-3 and a QRT, and another one where I had the caller's call sign and 3 comment lines. And that was enough information so that I could initiate a CQ, get a response back from someone with a signal report, send them back a signal report, send them back additional information or additional comments if necessary, and then send them a 7-3 and a termination of the contact. One thing I did notice about SSTV is that all of the contacts or all of the information that I was receiving was pretty much on 20 meters. I did see a few contacts or a few CQs go out on 15 meters using SSTV, but I didn't get complete transmissions. I don't know if it's my setup or if it's just the band conditions right now, but a lot of times I would get like the first third or maybe half of an image, and then the signal would go QSB and then I wouldn't receive the rest of it. 20 meters was a little bit better. I would get probably 75 to 95% of most of the transmissions on that band, which, by the way, if I remember correctly, is 14.230 for standard SSTV on 20 meters. I received lots of CQs. I watched lots of conversations before I actually tried to get in on one. Then finally, sometime, I think it was last weekend, I sent out several CQs, did not get any responses, and then finally, at long last, after sending out CQs for probably an hour, I finally got a response. I actually got to see a slow scan TV sent back to me with my call sign included and a signal report, and I actually responded back to it and everything, and got a full QSO and actually logged my very first slow scan television QSO on 20 meters. And I don't remember the call sign. I'd actually have to look at the log, but I believe it was a 4-call somewhere in the southeast. All of that was very cool, very enlightening, and I would definitely recommend that if you have never tried slow scan TV, you try it, because it's not like any other ham radio communication medium. It's not quick and dirty. It involves some real effort to get a good communication, a good contact. and get a good full sort of two-way handshake, to use a networking term, between contacts on SlowScan TV when there is actually so much data being sent over a narrow bandwidth path. It's very satisfying when you actually make a contact over SlowScan. So if anyone has any more questions they want to ask me about that, because I'm sure I didn't include nearly enough information about what I did to get it set up and working, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Just email me, k5tux@k5tux.us. I'd be happy to talk to you about SlowScan. But it's definitely something I'm really glad I did, because I'd never done it before. I'd always wanted to. And now, once I've kind of gotten over that somewhat steep learning curve of getting into how to use it and set it up and everything, and be able to get the templates to the point where it doesn't take a whole lot to actually make the communication, because it allows you to kind of just keep one thing sending over and over, and then put in the relevant details to complete QSOs. It's a lot easier than it used to be, but it's real fun, and I think everyone should try it. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So, and I know I talked for, probably a long time there. So anyone have anything to say about SSTV?
It's a lot of fun.
So obviously you've done it.
Yeah, but it's not very often, and it was just kind of what you did. It was more to check it out than anything else. And yeah, it is a little hard. You've got to figure out the images, and then that first one, it's like, okay, what do I do? How do I get his call sign in there? Because did you end up sending multiple pictures back and forth? So you send your CQ, and then some guys are really good. They send you one picture for the CQ, and then another one for the next part of the exchange, and then another one at the end for the 7-3. Is that how it worked with you?
That's how it worked from their end. Usually, yes, each part of the conversation had a different background picture, but yes, it's just as easy to choose the same background picture as a different one. So I just kind of went with the same one.
And that's what I did too. But there are some guys that really they have a big boatload of pictures to use. But anyway, it's a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. I don't know if it was just band conditions on my part, but I had a considerable amount of trouble actually trying to get a good, clear, 100% image out of SSTV. Most of them were like, good for half, and then they got really grainy, and then, the rest of it would be okay or something like that, or you only received 2/3 of it or anything like that. I assume it was just QSB on the band, but I never really, when you see images of people talking QSSTV, maybe they're talking about ham DRM and stuff like that, where it's all digital and, of course, all the images come through perfectly clearly. But in standard analog SSTV, most of the QSOs that I got were real pixel grainy, not real clear, but, at least legible enough to know that I made a contact.
And Kleewick is wondering, were you using the QSSTV in the Debian repository?
Yes, I was using QSSTV from the Debian repository. That's the software that I used.
And that's the one that I've used, and it seems to work pretty flawlessly. And it's actually pretty powerful. And relatively easy to use, wouldn't you agree?
It is relatively easy to use. It's just for some reason it's almost like a non-starter. You have to force yourself to figure out how to get that one image out on the air.
That's right. Yeah.
Once you get past that hurdle, because it's not the same as picking up a microphone and saying CQ, blah blah blah. There's a lot more work involved. You actually have to create an image, and it does. QSSTV does include an image editor, which allows you to create those images that you need to send, as your CQ image or as your reply image or, whatever it is. But the documentation is not super good. it's one of those things where it's not real difficult. It's not rocket surgery, as we'll hear about later in a comment. but it's one, you just have to sit down, you have to read the documentation, and you have to focus. If you can sit down and focus for 15 minutes, you'll have no problem doing this. But you have to focus. Once you get the images created, once you've got the idea of how the templates work sorted out, it becomes very easy. But if you don't have someone to sit there and hold your hand, it can take some time, and it can take some actual energy to figure out how to get started. But once you do, you'll look back on it like, why did I not get that right from the start? Because it's really not that hard. But I feel that way about a lot of things.
We did this again at my son's club, and just on 2 meter HTs, we were all in the same room. We sent SSTV images back and forth between each other, just holding up the handhelds to the laptops they were using. And the reason I bring it up is, if you've got somebody locally that you talk to regularly on 2 meters, and I know guys in my area have done this, and they have coordinated. You can do it over 2 meter FM. I know some guys in our area were on 2 meters FM on a local repeater, and then they were doing their SSTV on 2 meter sideband down at 144.220 or something like that. It makes it a lot less intimidating, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I imagine it would be if you're just doing a local point-to-point thing, especially over FM, because you probably get nice clear images.
Pretty clear. You can still, you know, sometimes they get crooked like they do because the timing's off or something like that. But, it, you know, and if anybody wants to see the grainy images that Russ is talking about, just Google SSTV images, and there's plenty of them.
Yeah, well, I've got a whole gallery full of grainy images on one nice thing about QSSTV and presumably all SSTV programs is that they have an auto-skew facility that will do a very good job of calculating those timing issues and actually reorienting your images so they look like they're supposed to, not a diagonal the way they come in. So that was a real help to me, especially when the band was kind of poor and the images were coming in really grainy. It was actually exceptionally good at making, because you could see it as each couple of lines of data would come in, it would reorient the image based on the timing that it was getting. And usually by the time it got to the point where the transmission was done, the image actually looked like a decent image, even if it started coming in pretty severely skewed. So it's a pretty good application.
I would agree. Cheryl, what about you?
Cheryl's like, I have no idea what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
What are you talking about? who the hell are you? Where am I? What day is this?
When's the time for the recipe corner?
Yeah, exactly. Well,
that's coming up very soon. So I do want to say that Ted in the chat room mentions qsl.net/k3asi/freakli.htm, and that is the website that I used for figuring out the calling frequencies for SSTV. So that link will be in the show notes too. So once you get QSSTV installed on your machine and get your images created and all of that kind of stuff, that's the place you want to go to find the place where you actually want to listen for other people's SSTV transmissions. And that's basically where I found them all. So it's a great resource for that. All right. That being said, we are down to music, finally, at long last. Yay. Woo! All right. And this music actually comes from Rich. Wow, Rich, you really just kind of jumped in and took over the show. So
I heard it on CC Hits, and that's how I found this band. I downloaded the album. Great driving music. If you're tired, not necessarily this song that we're going to hear, but the rest of the album, it'll keep you awake for hours. Hours. It's just got that kind of beat. Anyway.
Cool.
No, that is cool. And I actually listened to this track earlier, so I'm glad you picked it because I liked it quite a bit.
Oh, good.
And I tend to be a little picky about music, especially music that's not metal, but this is really good. Fits my taste profile quite well. I'm going to play it off of MySpace, which is where we got it from, or where you got it from, or where somebody got it from.
I did. They did release this album under Creative Commons. I don't think that on the MySpace page that it actually said that, but it has been released, and it was released, I thought, before 2010. Under Creative Commons. But anyway, I digress.
That's quite all right. Anyway, Rich did find this one. It's on MySpace. It's probably in other places as well. Presumably Creative Commons. Did come out in September of 2010. This is an American group. Runs about 3 minutes 20 seconds. The group is Sick of Sarah. And this particular song is called Simple Parts. I tried to play this a couple of times earlier and it hiccuped. So it may hiccup here on the live recording, but of course the released version will be flawless. So anyway, Let's listen to Simple Parts by Sick of Sarah, and then we'll talk about some other stuff.
Time goes by so fast. One last breath is all I have. The people come, they fade. I try so hard to shape these words I cannot formulate. It's hard enough to breathe, hard enough to fall. And I'll be sitting on your back porch, trying to figure out who you are.
Sick of Sarah. That's a pretty good track. I really like that one, Rich, so thanks for bringing it to my attention. Let me guess, Rich is muted.
I'm frantically clicking to unmute.
God, different hosts, same problems. Man.
Oh, man. You're fired.
Okay. Been nice knowing you.
I think that's actually hilarious. I was just commenting in the chat room about how good an episode this was, and yes, it's even better now. Anyway, that was a great track. I think almost anyone could enjoy that.
It was good.
It was good. Oh, wow, it's good. We got that from across the way, because you like about, what, 4% of the stuff they have. I play.
You always pick metal, and you know I listen.
Don't always pick metal.
No, it's pretty often.
I really like it. The rest of that album, it comes off of an album called 2205, and the rest of that album does not sound like that. So, but yeah, it's a I don't know, it's a good song.
It is a very good song.
So I went to a ham fest. Now I think you guys want to go to a ham fest.
Maybe.
Yes, we do actually want to go to a kind of well known ham fest.
Kinda.
Maybe you have an announcement to make.
We do, actually. There's this ham fest that comes up once a year in Dayton, Ohio, in May. We had been there for 5 consecutive years up until last year, when we didn't make it. But we are going to try and make it there again this year. I don't actually recall the date from this year because I didn't bother to write it down, but obviously it's about the third weekend in May, because that's when it always is. The Dayton Hamvention is rolling around again, and as like last year, we have an Indiegogo campaign up and running. Well, we already have a couple of donations, which is great. Thank you to those who have donated early. We're actually using Indiegogo's new facility called Generosity. This is for things that are non-project oriented. In other words, there's no physical outcome to the project at hand. This is actually for, you know, people who are sick or educational concerns, or you know, if you want to send water to Rwanda or whatever. You know, they have a new thing called generosity.com, and we are doing our fundraiser this year under that aegis. We have a link to that, which will be in the show notes, and I'll probably be posting that on our website. And I have been posting this every couple of days on social media, on Google Plus, on Facebook, on Twitter, and so forth. So the link to that will be, you know, everywhere. And if you're on social media, you'll see it. If you can't contribute monetarily, we would sure love if you could, you know, post it on your social media networks or send it in emails or, you know, however you want to get the word out. We would love to wind up at Hamvention again. We would love to set up a booth. We would love to be education for the open source community, for ham radio, using open source and all of that that we've done for many years in the past. So that link is out there. I hope everybody will be able to contribute if they can. And if you've seen this in the last couple of days, I just want to let everyone know that I have put out a bunch of new perks. These are perks that have not been in the last two Indiegogo campaigns, and I hope they'll be much more interesting to folks than some of the stuff we put up earlier. So there's cool stuff out there. There's lots of new things you can sort of purchase for your donation, including being a host of the show.
Ooh.
Which is something we haven't offered before, but we're offering it now. There's lots of stuff out there, everything from the $5 level all the way up to $500. So, you know, that should cover everybody's budget as far as I'm concerned. Even if you just want to throw a dollar our way, we would really appreciate it. And we would really hope that we get to see everybody in Dayton out in May. So did somebody look up the date for me?
20th through the 22nd.
All right, good deal. May 20th through the
22nd. 115 days away.
115 days away, cool. So if we meet our funding goal, we will be there and we'll see you all there. And of course, we'll have lots of swag to give away and lots of cool things and lots to talk about. And of course, our link to the generosity campaign will be in the show notes, and it's out on social media everywhere. So please contribute if you can. And if you can't, just let everyone you know about it through social media or whatever means necessary. And we thank you very much.
Now, Russ, I don't see the perks at the Generosity by Indiegogo.
You don't? You went to the link, right?
Well, I had the same problem the other day. I had to, like, dig around a little bit to find them.
Okay. Oh,
it's over on the side.
I see them now. Yeah. I see them now.
Yeah, okay, I did the same thing. Good. I was like, okay, there's nothing here. And I was like, oh, there they are. So
keep scrolling down, people.
Yeah, scroll down. There's a lot of scrolling to be done, by the way. So.
Hey, we don't have an LHS shot glass.
No, we're going to have one, though.
Ooh, cool.
Probably from that new site.
Probably.
That you guys mentioned last show.
It actually isn't, but...
Oh, okay. Oh, Sharpie.
Sharpie?
Sharpie on a shot glass, LHS.
Oh, yeah, right. We're just going to write on the shot glass. Yeah, LHS, yeah.
And I got plenty of crayons around.
Well, you know, actually, I don't know. I've done the like the stoneware mug with the Sharpie drawing on it. I've never tried doing it on glass, but I bet it would work.
We're just gonna have Cheryl put on lipstick and kiss all the shot glasses.
Sure.
That'll work. That'll get everybody in, I think.
There you go.
Well, I can't wait. You know, it's at 4%, and this show has 4% more badgers, so it's...
Well, it's actually, technically only 3%. We're working on 4%.
4%, yeah.
Trying to get that.
Oh, okay, mother.
Yeah, we got a ways to go.
All right, Rich, you got a couple stories here.
So we mentioned earlier the W0VFW in that in the story earlier out there in Wichita, Kansas. If you're around Wichita next Sunday, January 31st, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the VFW post at 3115 West Douglas, they're going to be operating. They're going to have the Dead of Winter Ham Radio event, and it coincides with Winter Field Day. Admission is free, and the event will promote involvement, and they hope to get people interested in becoming ham radio operators. So that's going on. And then this next one, gee, you left it in there. I didn't know if you would or not.
we talk about other people's shows all the time. We have no issue with that whatsoever.
Well, I found two. This one is ham radio. So the Everything Ham Radio podcast, he's already got three episodes out. It's Curtis Moore, K5CLM. And he says, hello, everybody, and welcome to the first normal episode of the Everything Ham Radio podcast. In this episode, we are talking about D-Star. And then in every episode, he has a little ham radio club spotlight, and then he does a little news. And so that's a new show you can listen to. He has an episode zero out as well that just talks about himself and why he's doing it. And I listened to that today, and I was certainly not turned off. I was impressed. So the more the merrier. Another podcast for the radio amateur.
Yep, that's always a good thing. We can't have too many of them, I don't think.
To fill the vast void OSWR has left.
That is very true. We're so sad about that. Well, we actually didn't call the demise of Low SWR the last time we talked about it. We gave you room for resurrection. We just
I have papers and papers and papers with ideas for shows, and I just have not had the motivation to do it.
Well, you know what? You have a new platform for those ideas.
Exactly. This is why the show is so long today.
All right. Well, that's very cool. I am actually anxious to check that out because I like hearing new people's views and everything. So I'm looking forward to it. Check out the Everything Ham Radio podcast hosted by Kilo 5 Charlie Lima Mike. Sounds interesting. We also have a comment on episode number 155 from Gary, KC3PO. Awesome call sign, by the way. And he says, this is actually in response to feedback we got two episodes back, maybe, from Scott, N8VSI, who asked about the little portable lollipop nodes for doing HSMM. And Gary says, it's not really rocket surgery, to call back to rocket surgery from earlier. A 5-gallon bucket as the base. The bucket holds the battery and is also filled with sand or cement. PVC pipe goes up from the bucket, serves as an antenna mast, antenna mounted on top, router and possibly other optional equipment such as a camera, mounted near the top in a suitable box. See the slideshow, I think slides 16 and 18 for visual from KC3PO. And the link, of course, to the information and the slideshow that he's talking about, which is actually in PDF format, will be in the show notes. It's actually provided by Whiskey 8, Mike, Romeo, Charlie. This is in response to setting up portable high-speed multimedia nodes for ham radio operation that Scott was asking about and that was talked that was brought up when Frank Howell was a guest on the show in episode number 155. So we'll have that information because I'm sure that will be of interest to Scott and probably lots of other people. And in response to upping our Badger quotient on the show, we have a voicemail from Matt Williams. And I have Kilo Charlie 8 Bravo Juliet Whiskey on here, and I don't think that's the right call sign. Can you look that up for me for real quick? I was doing that from memory, and I'm pretty sure I'm totally wrong. So
sounds close.
I know it's close, but close is not the right thing when you're talking about call signs.
No, I know.
That's Billy Ayler.
Oh, yeah, so that's definitely
that's definitely not right. So it's probably Bravo Whiskey Juliet instead of Juliet Whiskey.
There's a KD9BWJ, it's a Matthew Williams in Martinsville, Indiana.
That's it.
Kate, was it?
Kilo Delta 9, Bravo, Whiskey Juliet.
Okay, I was close. KD9, Bravo, Whiskey Juliet.
Yeah,
okay.
And he just answered me. He's online, so.
All right, so anyway, we also have voicemail from Matt Williams, Lord Drachenblut, Kilo Delta 9, Bravo, Whiskey Juliet, who is here to up our badger quotient. And believe me, there is no other purpose to this voicemail.
Hey, Russ and Cheryl. Badgers. Badgers. Badgers, badgers, badgers. Badgers, 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 badger, 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 badgers, 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 badgers. And did I mention badger, 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 badgers, badgers.
All right, if that doesn't up our badger quotient by at least a couple of points, then we've got some problems.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
He just said to check our Google Plus page about something he just posted about scale.
From Scale 14, Special Event Station, November 6, Sierra. We actually talked about this when we interviewed the guys from Scale. They talked about November 6, Sierra. So that information did go out in time. So I'm glad of that. All right, so anyway, thanks, thanks, Matt. Kilo Delta 9 Bravo Whiskey Juliet, now they get your call sign correct. For the added badgers, I will make sure to update the title on the website to make sure we retain all of our listeners with our appropriate at least 4% badger quotient. So,
yeah, I'm thinking that jumped up to 10,
yeah, it's probably about 9 now, so yeah. I think we're well over the limit. But... anyway, thanks to everyone who sent in feedback in one way or the other. We really appreciate that. It lets us know that you're listening. And, of course, we appreciate all of our listeners, every single one of you.
Yes.
Yep. All right, you know what that means. We're down to the best part of the program.
Well, maybe.
No, it's definitely the best part of the program.
All right.
It's
whatever.
Cheryl's Recipe Corner. So let's hear it.
All right.
Wir lieben Grünkernsuppe.
Yes. So today's recipe is for Grünkernsuppe. It's a traditional German spelt soup. And how we managed to stumble across this is Russ and our foodies. Sadly enough, but you can tell by our weight. And on Saturday, we traveled to Kansas City to do some shopping at IKEA, visit Weston Brewing in Weston, Missouri, and we're enjoying beverages from there at this very moment, and visit the Steamboat Arabia Museum, which, if you don't know anything about it, it was a steamboat that was taken down by a tree in the middle of the Missouri River in 1980. Well, the boat itself sank in 1856. They found it in 1988. So, anyway, at the end of our day, we enjoyed a lovely meal at Grunauer Restaurant, which is in a Frisco Freight building behind beautiful Union Station in Kansas City. We dined there during the Kansas City's Restaurant Week, so we had a three-course meal to enjoy. The soup was the dish that Russ chose for his first course. The rest of the meal was average until we got to the salted caramel pot de creme that we had for dessert. While the soup is, Russ was very concerned about the pot de creme until he got a taste of it, and then it was a fight over it. So while the soup is not something we've made at home yet, it will be something we do in the very near future. I love soup in the winter, especially with the pot de creme for dessert. So anyway, the soup has butter, veggies, and spelt berries. Which, don't confuse us with spelt flour. Some broth. You can use chicken, vegetable, or beef. You can put meat in it if you like, or you can leave it out. It's up to you. A few recipes I found mentioned either bacon or chicken or cooked sausage. Choices are endless. Then once it's all done, you drizzle a little bit of cream on the top, salt and pepper it, and enjoy it. So, and the recipe makes 4 to 6 servings approximately. If you don't know where to get spelt berries, check out your local natural food store. You can get it online locally through Aiken.com, which is a store that we have here locally, but they're all over the United States. Amazon carries it as well. Search for Bob's Red Mill Spelt Berries. You can do anything with it. More meat, no meat, more veggies, less veggies, different veggies, you know, just whatever. If you want a brothy soup, leave the recipe as it's written. If you want something that's thicker, you can puree everything together before you put it in your bowls. So,
and I have to say, I didn't know what to expect out of the spelt soup. It sounded interesting, and with the restaurant week menu, you were limited to a certain number of appetizers and a certain number of entrees. You could only pick a couple of things. And with the appetizers, there were only two things you could choose from. One was a salad and one was a soup. So we decided to try both of them. So Cheryl ordered the salad, I ordered the soup, and we decided to share them. But I have to say, both the salad and the soup were outstanding. And considering what was in both of them, they're not things that I would have like chosen like just because I chose them. Due to the fact that we were limited to those two items, we kind of had to choose them. Because the salad was basically like arugula with
golden beets, yeah, and craisins.
Golden beets and cranberries with feta cheese, I think, mm-hmm. And a dressing, which actually turned out to be amazing.
Yeah.
And the spelt soup, which is like a grain soup, which had like small pieces of carrots and stuff like that, and actually just a little dose of heavy cream kind of mixed in at the end. It doesn't sound like much, but when you taste it, it's actually pretty amazing. So if you get the opportunity to try this, and if you're kind of a soup person and you like a warm soup on a cold day, this is pretty amazing, and it doesn't require a whole lot of work to get it done.
No.
It's not a very involved process to making the soup. So I definitely would highly recommend giving this one a shot. Definitely a little more upscale than some of the things we've been talking about lately.
Most people don't know anything about spelt berries.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know anything about spelt berries until we had it.
We didn't know anything about spelt berries until this week. So
yeah, well, the next recipe is going to be the caramel pot de creme.
Ted says...
People should Google that. Yeah. Just Google pot de creme. P-O-T-D-E. Oh, my gosh, it looks really good. Does it have any eggy flavor at all?
No, it's actually like a really thick... moussey pudding type thing.
It's like eating a jar of caramel mousse. It's like it's just amazing.
Yeah, well, it was a salted caramel, and it had like little anise cookies or something that came with it. I know.
It's like to die for.
Yeah, Russ was the choices for the desserts was apple strudel or the pot de creme, and I'm not a big apple dessert person. I'm just. That's Russ's thing. He loves apples. He loves, you know, pies and things like that. So, you know, when it came down to the end, we had lunch there. So of the three courses, we could only pick two, but we could add the dessert for $5 or something, $6. So we decided to split the pot de creme, and it came out in a pint mason jar. That's what they had baked it in. And Russ, you know, they set it down in front of me because I was the one who ordered it. And Russ was like, I don't know. And I tasted it. I was like, oh, my God, you'll love this. So he took a little bite of it. He's like, oh, hey, scoot that over here. So, and then we were like, you know, because they brought out like ice drink spoons to eat it with because the jar size. And we at the end, we were like digging in the bottom for the last little bites of it. So,
well, I know when I was reading the menu, when I saw the description of the pot de creme, I was...
concerned.
My brain read the description as something akin to creme brulee, and I hate creme brulee.
Right.
So I didn't want to order it, but when we found out that we only got two of the courses instead of three, because we thought we were getting three and we were going to each take one of the desserts and then share, I decided that I didn't want a dessert, and so we had to choose between the two of them, so I left it up to Cheryl, and Cheryl obviously wanted the pot de creme, so we got that. Now I'm glad that's the way we went, because it's It was truly an amazing dessert, and it is nothing like creme brulee. So
no, it's nothing like creme brulee. I had had pot au creme before, but and I thought Russell had been with me when I had it, and he said no.
No, so, I'd never had that before.
Yeah.
No, so. I'd never had that before because I would be swimming in a vat of it if I had ever had it before. So
well, maybe when you get home from work on Wednesday night after your long drive, you'll come home to some pot au creme.
Oh, that sounds good.
You can only hope.
Yes, yeah. I can only, that's right. I can only hope.
So the spot, go ahead.
This Grankensuppe, I have family in Switzerland. My grandma lives there.
Right.
And I've been there a couple times. And every day for lunch, and this is when I was a young child, 10 years old, we had soup for lunch every day. And it looks very similar to this. I mean, not every day in the same soup, but there was soup every day, some kind of soup. And this looks very similar to
it. It probably is because the recipes that I ended up finding.
You found were Danish, right?
Yeah, they were like, or Dutch. They were all recipes Dutch, and I had to translate the pages, and yeah, but I found tons of them.
I see on chefkoch.de, that's a German site. There. Right, DE right. is Germany, so anyway, wow. That's
no, DE like is that. Deutschland.
Ja, ja, Deutschland.
Ja, ja, Deutschland, you call me.
This would be for our German listeners.
Right.
Am Samstag, dem Russen, ich reisten nach Kansas City zum Einkaufen bei IKEA. In Western Missouri. Wir gehen heißen Getränke von dort in diesem Augenblick.
very good. German is funny.
Yes. Yeah, we live 3 miles from a German community. You should kind of be used to it by now. With Amish neighbors that speak German as well. So
all right, enough of that. We need to move on. We're over 2 hours on this show already. So
we are. So.
All right. So that's Cheryl's Recipe Corner, and we're gonna move on to the social media roundup. So all right then.
All right, I'm hitting it. This week for donations and subscriptions, we have Michael Aiello, Mike Lasky, and Ronald Nesler. On Facebook, we have Roman Mileiki, Antoine Joyner, Nico Van Tonder, and John Ropesh. Google Plus, we have Antonio H., Karthik Shah, Chris Nelson, John Van Igdom, Eric Bond, and William Buck. Twitter, we have Going Linux with a side note of Larry, what took you so long? Woody, VE2GZIKM6MO, PA3HCM. Nobody joined us on YouTube. Mike Lasky did join our mailing list, and we had no merchandise sales.
Well, we might have had merchandise sales, but I actually haven't had a chance to check. But I'm assuming we don't have merchandise sales, because we almost never do. But
sometimes it happens.
It does happen once in a blue moon. And hopefully if we actually get moved over to Spreadshirt, then maybe we'll get more. We'll see. Or maybe if we start operating or offering shot glasses, we'll get even more. Yeah.
Well, yeah, some people don't have our shot glass collection desires.
You know. No, that's true. But there's always a use for a shot glass.
Well, yeah.
Because it's a 1 ounce glass. If nothing else, you can use it to measure flour. Who knows? You know, you'll figure something out.
Measure the spelt berries.
There That's right. Go.
Measure the spelt berries for your. Wait a minute. Let me go up and look.
Your, 6 ounces.
No. What? The name of it. The Grunkernsuppe. Yeah.
That.
That's the thing I was looking for. Right. So anyway, you know what that means, right?
It's time to get out of here.
Yeah, the show is over. So thanks, Rich. It's good to have you here.
Yay.
As our new man about town.
And that was fun.
And comedic whatever.
Comic relief or whatever it is.
Comedic quaaludes.
There you go.
We talk about those way too often. All right. Anyway, I think I'm going to hit the button, which I've just done, and there's music, so we're going to get on out of here. So you can become an LHS ambassador, and we've heard from an LHS ambassador who turned co-host tonight. Visit the website for upcoming events and information on how you can represent Linux in the Ham Shack at a nearby LinuxCon or HamFest. We love feedback. You can email us at info@lhspodcast.info. You can comment on an episode on the website, post on Google+, Facebook, or Twitter, or leave us voicemail at 1-909-LHS-SHOW. That's 1-909-547-7469. You can visit our IRC channel, #LHSPodcast, on the Free Node Network, and you can subscribe to our mailing list, links on the website. Show merchandise from coffee mugs to t-shirts can be purchased currently at cafepress.com/LHSPodcast. We'll probably be moving that over to Spreadshirt coming up in the near future. You can also help the show by clicking on the sponsored ads in the right-hand column of the homepage. That doesn't cost you anything except a moment of your time. It sends us a couple of cents our way. We appreciate it. You can listen to us live every other Monday night at 8 o'clock Central Time. That's Tuesday night, 0100 Zulu time. I believe it's actually 0200 Zulu time now that we're in the winter. And our recording schedule and countdown timer to the next episode is on the website, and that website is lhspodcast.info. And that site contains everything you ever wanted to know about our show, Linux in the Ham Shack. So thank you to all of our listeners, live, quasi-live, past, present, and future. We appreciate each and every one of you, and look forward to having you listen to us again in 2 weeks' time. So for Rich, KD0RG, and for Cheryl, who sits across from me, and for me, Russ, K5TUX, coming to you from Studio 3D in lovely, bitterly cold Southwest Missouri, we will hope to hear from you all again in 2 weeks' time. Bye for now. Och, snach.